Good evening all, and thank you very much, Stanley, for that lovely introduction. I'm delighted to be back in Cork. I was here for the Spring Poetry Festival some years back. I see Patrick here in front of me, and I enjoyed it very much. I'd like to open with a very simple poem from my first collection, Opposite Walls, in fact, the title poem from that collection. It's really about a child's perception of history and how, you know, confusing Irish history can be. Because when I grew up in Granard in County Longford, there were two prints on the wall, on opposite walls. One was of the Battle of Mons in Belgium in 1915, so we're celebrating the centenary of that now, and the other was of the 1916 Revolution, the Rising in Dublin. And in some strange way, I grew up between the two pictures. Opposite walls. The Battle of Mons hung on the wall, a black and white print with the 9th Lancers charging, horses' eyeballs wild with war, fierce spikes on the German helmets. Across from Mons, on the opposite wall, a print of the 1916 Rising. Sandbags piled in the windows, Connolly on a stretcher, Pierce's side face pale with the thoughts of surrender. The Kaiser Kelly fought in both wars, my father said. Every time I sat down to eat, I saw him leave Mons, hurdle over plates, sugar and milk across the table to be in Dublin for the Rising. And now, just to go on the landscape poem of Cavan, you're probably all very familiar with the Quilca Mountains, where the Shannon rises. And the Quilca Mountains are extraordinary, but there are two great peaks there. And in some ways, they reminded me of Mother Earth. And it has that strange look about it, that wild look, where in many ways the farmers are trying to tame the wildness of this, of Mother Nature. And at the same time, she seems to be able to surpass all those challenges. And of course, Quilca is the Irish for quilt, meaning chalky, a chalky face. Stanley said, I like Irish, and every now and then I use the Irish language in my writing. Quilca. This woman is strange. Perfume of moss and wild asphodel, squatting here in the wilderness, blanket of bog about her shoulders, her fierce breasts held in place by whins and heather. Sheep graze in her, birds wing across her limbs, the wind gives her words, the sun lights up her chalky face. Farmers drive stakes to her peaty flesh. Black streams are veins winding slowly round her hips. Bog water trickles down her legs. And now to a poem entitled Primal Loss. It's a poem I wrote in praise of John Montagu on his 80th birthday. John Montagu, as you're very familiar, I'm sure, in Cork, taught in the university, taught English, and in many ways he encouraged creative writing with his students. People like Theo Dorgan and Greg Delante and other names like that, come possibly Patrick Cotteran, but to show a lot of people started writing under his inspiration. And he was very helpful to me when I was starting off. Sometimes the generosity of other poets can help you when you're starting a first or a second collection. And as you know, John Montagu was born in Brooklyn in 1929. He's still with us, and he, in some strange way, of course, he was sent back as a child. His mother and father, his father had been involved with the IRA and was on the run in America, and they sent the child, John, back at the age of 3 or 4, around that, to live with his aunts in Garvahy, at one stage in Tyrone, and summer holidays down in Abbey Lara in County Longford. So it's just 2 miles from Granard, where I lived. And I think that in many ways affects his great writing. Primal loss for John Montagu on his 80th birthday. The loss of the first love of your life left you clasping at the blankets of sleep. Your heart tugging to free itself, dreaming of a mother's smile that failed to show her face. You took grief for a walk about the fields of Garvahy, straying past dolmens of childhood, determined to put your point across. All roads lead to that primal loss. You stopped looking in the same direction as everybody else, mapped a new projection, few signposts. You learned the language of verse, shaped poems from stones in the rough field, found the locket your mother wore, revealing a photo of a boy with curls in Brooklyn. Now we talk about the Leaving Cert, and some of my poems were all for the Leaving Cert, but in some strange way, the Leaving Cert haunted me for many years afterwards. I don't know, did you ever have those dreams that you didn't get the exam, you know what I mean? And you wake up in a sweat, you know, and then you're very relieved to know that actually that's not true, it was just a nightmare. So, and I think the Leaving Cert is starting next Wednesday week, isn't that right? So I think for anybody here in the audience, it's not to put you off, it's just to remind you of what's ahead, really. It's entitled Ghost of the Leaving Cert. The ghost of the Leaving Cert is ubiquitous. I hear Hablet shouting at his father. See a disembodied Wordsworth picking daffodils. Michael Collins with the treaty sealing wax in his mouth, pretending not to cry. The ghost of the Leaving Cert has a clock face to draw silence down upon us. Someone coughs, a page turns, lazy buzz of bumblebee in the window. A pen falls, the ghost walks, stops, walks on again. The ghost of the Leaving Cert confines me to facts and formulae. Words slowly clutter. This is not the answer I intended to write. You can never tell where the ghost of the Leaving Cert will lead you. A knock to the exam center's door. A tray of Kimberley biscuits, cup of coffee for the ghost only. The ghost of the Leaving Cert haunts me, screams at me. I told you so. The questions don't know the answers. A giant rubber erases them. Mad Sweeney flies off with the sealed envelope. I get no results. Next poem is entitled Bohlan Bui. I don't know, you're probably familiar with the ragwort. You know that lovely weed that grows by the side roads, and actually, in the 1950s and early 60s, you could be summoned if you're in the farming business and you didn't cut the ragwort or the bohlons. But I like to think of the bohlon as a type of a metaphor for poetry or for the Irish language, that in some strange way it always survives. Bohlan Bui. The wild bee tosses my yellow hair where I reside along a closed railway line, since government survey mapped my decline. From that day forward, pain was always near, living as I do in mist, fog, and fear. Staggerweed, stammerwort, names from outside with their intended power to deride, can't rob me of pollen and nectar here. I love the risk, pleasure of the abyss. I am the shoemaker come out of darkness. Forsaken, I close my daisy yellow eyes on that grey, incontinent Irish sky. Whisper my name whenever you need me. Bohlon, Bohlon, Bohlon Bui. And now I'd like to read an extract from a long poem entitled Sipna Fi Vauron Gali, Sweeney Under a Full Moon. It's just, it's a poem really about the Bull of Sipna, that manuscript that you have out in Brussels, and of course you'll find two copies or two versions of it in the Royal Irish Academy. It's going back to pagan times, and you had Mad Sweeney, who was king of the Dalara or Dalriada up in Antrim and Down. And then, of course, you had St. Ronan, who was the saint of that area just after the coming of Christianity. And Sweeney, by the way, Sweeney, you know, is very much part of the At Swim Two Birds by Miles Nagopoline, and Seamus Heaney also used the Sweeney Astray. So it's one of those things that you try your hand at, you know what I mean, sometime or another. But I love the part where the saint turns him into a bird. Sweeney strips off naked. He's tired listening to bells. He's tired listening to the monks and the Christianity. He loves his paganism. So he strips naked and he runs up and he grabs the psalter from the saint and he throws it down the well. And then, as a reprisal, the saint turns him into a bird. So he has to fly all around Ireland. I'm sure he came to Cork at some stage, you know. He certainly came to Cavan and different places. And he ended up in Carlow, you know, the rest is history. But anyway, I'll read the little section in Irish and then read the translation. Is that all right? And I know Cork loves Irish language, anyway, so I'm home ground, I think. Quer Ronan aig fiddle Sifna. Bauran gali os a chion, go be in a gridam a mock on a veil, cletchi in on a gruig, as we sifna in weir bocha, in tubber na vocha, in anshar kuga wera, shake head trepe shan. Ard ar e sifna, id a gaw chid talag, id a gaw cheer, id a gaw agna, ar vruach loca, ar vruach awan, ag bratno fein sa skahan ishka, agus evnas leish fein. Ayart leim war gunta godonna, bionar breg an a gulp, los ganahar gan wahar mor himpele, los na man si a vulu an a chligan, los fwi bialt an ag lunru, fwi skon at a loga, kikals na grein yar an ishka, goch chalcha, sa nasuk, in Lan Mulcan. Ronan put a mask over Sweeney's face. A full moon above him, a bird's beak breaking out of his mount, feathers instead of hair. And Sweeney was in danger of drowning in a well of words at the time of the Battle of Moira, 637. A great man, that Sweeney, between two places, between two countries, between two minds, looking at himself in a water mirror by the lakeside, on the river bank, and he all delighted with himself. An educated look, badly bruised, fool's watercress in his gob, duckweed all around him, foxglove ringing in his skull, marsh marigolds yellowing under an umbrella of leaves, play of sunlight on the water, a voice lost in the wilderness in Glen Vulcan. And now I'd like to read the calf bearer, really, that celui qui porte un veau, the one who carries the calf, which is the collection that was translated into French just last October. It was inspired when I was over in the Acropolis in Athens, and in the museum there, I saw this beautiful statue or sculpture piece of a man carrying a calf on his shoulders. And it reminded me of my father, because I come from a farming stock. And you know, the piece had that just determined look that Irish people or Irish farmers have, you know, always looking ahead and seldom looking back. And that strength and determination seemed to have been captured by the artist. The calf bearer. It wasn't the forelocks of the marble horse or the ringlets of Corley that caught my eyes, but the calm and stare of the calf bearer in the Museum of the Acropolis. A farmer like my father, with a calf slung over his shoulder, the field his altar. He knows the agony of clay, the language of weather, blaze of sun, squally winds, apples dropping on the lap of autumn, winter under the trees of the moon. Travelling alone down the mountainside, at one with the secrets of stone and clay, eyes set on the road ahead, never looking back, the house always somewhere in the distance. And I'd like to read now just a section from The Diary of a Town. It's a very long poem, so I'm only reading a short section of it. I'd be here for about 3 hours, really. It's based, really, on Granard, really, where I was growing up. And it's also about, really, the sounds that people make. And also, sometimes we forget to record what people dream about and what people talk about in their sleep can be as important as what they do in their consciousness. So it was very much, you know, trying to play around. I think one person told me once that if you live till you're 75 or 76, you know, you spend about maybe 14 to 15 years dreaming. You don't even think about it, and we fail to maybe respond to that great energy in the subconscious when writing. I think, for me, I think a lot of times poetry is about recording the subconscious. And this is just at night time. Winking stars appear, little windows to our souls in darkness. The town's voice quietens into the night, inner voices of the people sing to themselves in sleep. Their voices rise above the chorus of the day, above the crowd, mob, and congregation. They sing alone in sleep. Mary Major screams internally. Someone is walking inside her heart, and she feels the thud of his boots in her blood. Mother Angela sprinkles children's tears about the playground. Bogan Kiernan, retired commercial traveller, rides a bicycle through the roads and byways of his dreams. Canon O'Kane, parish priest, carries everyone's cross up Main Street, up the hill, across a desert of ploughed land to a field of stones. Mike the barber looks into a big mirror and shaves the dead face of every man in town. Mary Verdon remembers her childhood and cries all night beside the turnip pulper in the shed. Mrs. Blaney writes messages to herself each day and reads them aloud in her sleep. Dear Mrs. Blaney, Remember to leave the key under the mat, just in case Mr. Blaney returns unexpectedly from the grave. And report the scoundrels of children that knock and kick down your door to the master, the nuns, the priests and the guards. And don't forget to boil the potatoes and pay for the milk and bread. And God willing, leave money for the priest in case you die in your bed. Yours truly, May Blaney. And before I read the final poem, I'd like to thank Paul for inviting me here this evening. It's wonderful, and I'd like to thank Stanley here for the kind introduction. And it's wonderful to see such a great crowd on Monday night in Cork, you know, at a poetry reading. And congratulations to all of you for this wonderful achievement. 409th reading. 9 is my lucky number, so I'm delighted to share that wonderful with you. Thanks to Africa and Patrick, whom I know as poets, fellow poets as well. Thanks to for turning up. The last poem is entitled "The Funeral Game." It was a lucky poem for me because it won a big prize. I won't say the money because you see I'm living in Calvin now for so many years, so we have to keep that down, that notion. But the funeral game really is about a childhood retrieved when, you know, at one stage. Because we didn't have television, we were very creative, and we must have went through a depressing winter because we acted out funerals, burying little chickens and kittens, you know, secretly, and we dressed up and acted the whole thing out, you know, strange little madness. I couldn't imagine young people doing that today. Not as morbid. The funeral game. That winter, we came to terms with death. Every shoebox was a coffin for anything small and dead. And we wrapped them in calicoes, velvets. We grabbed hats, coats, umbrellas from the hallway to dress as mourners. Someone struck an iron girder in the hay shed to sound the funeral bell. John Joe beat the dead march on a saucepan. We held wakes, issued death certificates to all crows, kittens, chickens, lined the graves with stones, erected crosses with ash sticks. We pretended to cry, struggled with Latin prayers, filled the wet grave in the clover field, genuflected in the direction of a whin bush. The rain pelting down, we left by a side gap, back to the hay shed, for tea, bread, butter, for all who travelled long journeys. Thank you very much.